Before we start, a quick reminder. This podcast discusses sex, violence, and social oppression. It may be uncomfortable or triggering to some. If you're listening out loud, parts of this narrative may seem sensitive to those around you. We're 12 episodes into the podcast. That means that this is the final episode of our season. When I started working on this show, I didn't fully know what I would find along the way. That was part of the search, part of the allure. All I knew was that I wanted to learn more about a landmark case, to go beyond the clickbaity headlines and see if there was some roadmap or blueprint of some kind. Some way to understand whether the courts and judicial systems can help minority groups access their rights. Growing up, I was defined by membership in a minority community, both by the society I lived in and by extension, the identity I carved out for myself. I grew up in Sri Lanka, a country which was plagued by ethnic conflict. And even though I didn't witness the worst of the war with my own eyes, I felt connected to Tamils across the country. We didn't all personally know each other, but it still felt like we belonged to a community. A community built on a shared language and customs, but also a shared sense of otherness. But what does it mean to belong to a community? And coming back to this podcast, how do you define the word when you're referring to a group as diverse as the LGBTQI+ community? It is, after all, represented by one of the ultimate symbols of diversity, a rainbow. That's a loaded question and probably not one that we can answer today, but I'm very aware of the fact that in this podcast, we've referred to the queer community a lot. When we talked about the reaction to the NAS Foundation's petition of 2001, we said the community opposed it. Lawyer Anand Grover said that initially, he didn't get the community's buy-in. The Supreme Court's 2018 verdict against Section 377 offered an apology to members of the community. When we take legal action and file a petition, our claim in court is that the law impacts us as individuals. But the verdict will have the potential to affect other people. Any change will be applicable to everyone. Litigation then is an individual process with a collective impact. So when you file a petition in the court, how much is it your responsibility to think of the other people who might be affected by the outcome? From ATS Studio, I'm Sindhuri Nandakumar, and this is the 12th and final episode of 377, a show about a stubborn law, its unjust impact, and the movement to get rid of it. In July 2018, the Supreme Court of India heard the matter of Navtej Johar and others versus the Union of India, along with a number of related cases. All of them were trying to get rid of Section 377 of the Indian Penal Code, the notorious colonial-era law which, effectively, criminalized homosexuality. Navtej Johar and others refers to five queer Indians who had petitioned the court directly, arguing that Section 377 violated their fundamental rights. Despite the success of 2018 for queer people, there were some activist groups and coalitions who were frustrated by the manner in which the victory had been won. Some felt excluded. Lawyer Anand Grover, who had been involved in the legal fight since 2001, compared the feeling to a heartburn. This became evident in January 2018 when the Navtej Johar petitions were listed for hearing. Other less famous petitions were left hanging. Here's Anand.
A lot of people said, how can this happen? There's a lot of heartburn within the community that these people have come in last moment. They've never worked for the community and most of them represented highly, you know, very rich people who didn't actually suffer privations in terms of having to go and to the police station or even being arrested.
The problem was not that they had filed a petition, but that they had done it without engaging with the community. Saurabh Kirpal is one of the lawyers who represented Navtej Johar and his peers. I asked him what he thought.
to expect that there should have been a community discussion before filing this case is to really misunderstand the role of the court. It has never happened in the past, and I hope it never happens in the future. Individuals are liberty to go to court.
Going to court may have had a widespread effect on other people, but how do you determine who these other people are? Who is actually a member of this community and who speaks for it?
Who determines who is to approach the court? How do we decide which is the constituency which will actually vote and determine whether we should go or not? It's not as though there is like some kind of electoral roll of gay people available where all gay people now choose as to whether we should move or not. There is a certain self-identified set of activists who can hardly claim to be representative of the community themselves, really. And that is not how a constitutional scheme is.
This point is important. Anyone can access the court. It is your individual right as a citizen to do so. Litigation is not a community process, but this case had kind of developed into one. I spoke with Chenika Shah, a member of Labia, which is an LGBT collective representing queer feminist voices. Back in 2001, Chenika was one of the people who was critical about the NAS Foundation's petition in the Delhi High Court, and she voiced her thoughts. Now, when she looks back on it, she's glad that her feedback was taken seriously.
And it was wonderful that people responded to it by actually addressing it rather than running away from it. So that's in 2001.
But Chenika concedes that the mobilization that ensued can't really be seen as a community process.
So I'm not saying that we were all like one community. We can never be one community. We are very different. Those meetings allowed us to figure out who was where and what were they doing. But to say that it's not something that community has a role to play, I think is very, very flawed in my understanding and in our understanding as a collective as well. Because we believe that all knowledges are built through collective experience. A lot of lesbian, bisexual women and trans people have many other needs which were not being projected in this battle. But nonetheless, we were there as part of these voices. So these voices were part of that conversation. And they did influence how do you word when you go into court. I disagree completely that community voices are not important. They're very important. I mean, if the case was fought in isolation in the Supreme Court or in the Delhi High Court for 8 years with nobody talking about it and nobody doing anything about it, it would not have, I mean, the climate would not have changed. And if you had taken some 6 individuals from that time only, there were these successful people, taken their voices and gone, maybe you would have won the case. But would the change have happened in society? So law is, you know, legal cases are fought for many reasons. To win the case, yes. But to also create an environment in which that win makes sense is part of why you do the cases. Otherwise, why am I interested? I'm not a lawyer.
To Chenika, this wasn't just a fight against the law. It had evolved into a legal movement. Tarunab Khethan, a legal scholar, also talked about how groups like Voices Against 377 helped broaden the discourse during the whole process.
They used the court battle to inform the political discourse and the cultural discourse. They fought on multiple fronts, and that's been highly unusual. So they used the legal process to gain visibility for the LGBTQ movement, to reach out to politicians, to engage in the cultural debate about alternative sexualities being un-Indian.
The more I spoke with people, the more I understood that this isn't a simple issue. And the petitioners aren't the only side to consider. I'm struck by something Arvind Narayan said to me. When I asked him about individual petitioners versus community, he urged me to not just look at the people fighting the case, but also at the judgment.
History owes an apology.
He cited Justice Indu Malhotra's words, her apology to the queer community and their families for all they had suffered.
So what is Justice Indu Malhotra in effect saying? She's saying that actually this case is not about a petitioner. It's about the community. So the center stage is the community.
Let's take a look at the verdict. 500 pages of lyrical text which quotes Shakespeare, Goethe, and even Leonard Cohen. What did it have to say? September 6th, 2018. We're inside the sprawling campus of the Supreme Court of India, where things are looking busier than usual. Cameras, journalists, lawyers in their signature black robes, petitioners, people clamoring for access to courtroom number one. Today, the court was convening to deliver the much-awaited verdict in the matter of Navtej Johar and others versus Union of India. After just 4 days of hearings in July, they had reserved their judgment.
Our top story today, whether gay sex remains a crime in India, will be decided by the Supreme Court today. The five-judge constitution bench, headed by the Chief Justice of India, Deepak Mishra, and including Justice Mohinder Nariman, Justice M. Khanwilkar, Justice D.Y. Chandrachur, and Justice Indu Malhotra, will decide whether Section 377, which is a controversial British-era ban on consensual gay sex, violates specific articles of the constitution.
The judges walk in. Chief Justice Mishra opens. He says they're all of concurring opinion before he starts reading out the judgment. All five judges agreed that Section 377 of the Indian Penal Code, insofar as it applied to consenting adults, violated the Constitution of India. The judgment in Suresh Kumar Kaushal is therefore overruled. The judges say that individual liberty is the soul of the Constitution, and 377 violates that. Justice D.Y. Chandrachud reads the lyrics of a Leonard Cohen song, Democracy. From the wars against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming. Let's step outside the courtroom for a bit. On the lawns of the Supreme Court grounds stands a tall black bronze sculpture on a 7-foot-high platform. It's an imposing sight. It was made by the late artist Chintamani Kar, and it features a lady and a child reading a book engraved with the scales of justice. The child represents the young Republic of India, and the book is the laws of our land. Young, growing, evolving, learning. A country is founded on a constitution. It represents what we, the people, want our country to be. A sovereign democratic republic with justice, liberty, and equality for all its citizens. When a law finds itself in opposition to those goals, we adjust it. We evolve, and we're stronger for it. The judgment in Navtej Johar addresses this point by talking about the notion of transformative constitutionalism. CJI Mishra said that the purpose of having a constitution is to transform society so that it can be more in line with the values highlighted in the constitution, to make us more egalitarian, pluralistic, and inclusive. Here's lawyer Arundhati Kadju explaining the idea in an interview.
Now, the two points that really come out through this judgment are, one, they talk about India's transformative constitution. So we know we're a young country, right? This is the future. And they really talk about how this constitution is meant to transform us from a feudal society to a modern society. And judgments like this, and the fact that five judges have spoken through these four judgments, help to do that.
Back inside the courtroom, the last judge to read from her opinion is Justice Indu Malhotra. She reads just one paragraph.
History owes an apology to the members of this community and their families for the delay in providing redressal for the ignominy and ostracism that they have suffered through the centuries.
The reference to an apology really struck a chord. It acknowledged that the suffering of queer people goes far, far back in time. It talks about majoritarian views being imposed at the cost of the freedom of minorities. Here's lawyer Menaka Guruswamy talking about it soon after the verdict.
I think that Justice Malhotra really captured, I think, the essence of really a core constitutional value, which is to make reparations and to heal. And if you want to heal, the first step is to acknowledge that something has gone wrong, to apologize for it. I think it was a very sensitive, very big moment today, because it showed something. It showed something very interesting about our top court, that it is a deeply introspective institution, and that it accepts when it makes mistakes and it changes course. That is a very big plus for Indian democracy.
As a guiding light for transformative constitutionalism, is a principle called constitutional morality. This was a term widely cited in the Nas Foundation verdict of the Delhi High Court in 2009, which says that the Constitution should detect our norms for morality rather than the court of public opinion.
It has to be constitutional morality, which is to be basis for the state's right to interfere with the person's fundamental right.
Just because the majority of the people in a country might think that homosexuality is wrong doesn't mean it should be illegal. Instead, we should be asking ourselves, what does the Constitution say? On what values have we founded our country? Even though India's Constitution doesn't mention queer people, it offers a guarantee of equality to all citizens. That is why, even though the document doesn't explicitly spell out rights for marginalized groups, it can be used to argue on their behalf. That's why NALSA was able to recognize the rights of transgender Indians, why the courts could provide inheritance rights for daughters, grant equality of rank in the Indian Army for women. So, every constitutional judgment presumably takes us closer towards the country we want to be, to a more modern society. In 2009, the Delhi High Court's landmark ruling did that. In 2013, the Supreme Court rolled it back. But now, in 2018, it was correcting its errors to move forward. How then did this verdict build on the earlier Delhi High Court verdict of 2009? Lawyer Arvind Narayan had an interesting way of thinking about this. His question essentially was, what did Navtej give us that Nas didn't?
How did Navtej, what are the steps Navtej took which Nas did not take?
There is, of course, the idea of transformative constitutionalism, which we talked about earlier. The other major concept is the idea of non-retrogression, which in simpler terms means rights, once given, can't be taken away.
You can't take this right away. You can't do this like, you know, give you the right, take the right back again. So that's an important doctrinal development.
And there's the apology that Justice Malhotra talks of. A court making an apology is no simple thing.
The point that judges make really, really powerfully is to say that when you think of an apology, it's not a backward-looking gesture. It's a forward-looking gesture. What is the idea of an apology? An apology is not that I'm sorry and then I continue doing what I'm doing. An apology is only meaningful when it means that what you've done, you're not going to do again. Like, for example, now we can think, oh, what did an apology mean to the manual scavenging community? What did an apology mean to the migrant workers community? What did an apology mean in a range of these contexts? That's a question which one can raise.
And as for the point of community, which we opened this episode with, Arvind argues that the judgment focused more on community than on individual petitioners.
So did the issue of the person make a substantial difference in the court? I'll argue no, because you read Navtej. If I remember... Yes, I'm right about this. If I remember, you read the entire 500 pages of Navtej's judgment, there's not one paragraph saying who is Navtej. There's not one discussion of how Navtej's rights are violated. Navtej is only a figure to enter this issue. So what is Justice Ignu Malhotra in effect saying? She's saying that actually this case is not about a petitioner. It's about the community. So the center stage is the community.
The 2018 case of Navtej Johar and others, Akai Padmashali and others, Arif Jaffer, Ashok Rao Kavi, Keshav Suri, and the IIT students is a landmark case. Many people have remarked admiringly on the court craft, the moving speeches, and the legal arguments. But perhaps it's important to remind ourselves that this happened in tandem with a community mobilization effort. An imperfect one, yes, where some voices were louder than others, but a mobilization nonetheless. This involved community meetings, sensitization and awareness building workshops, the emergence of a coalition. Teams of lawyers and activist organizations worked together to build a concerted strategy. Despite the media gravitating towards stories of individuals, this battle was about a group of people. I let Arvind have the last word.
But the question, of course, is would the strategic call have been of value in the absence of this campaign at the level of the street, at the level of the media, level of public opinion, is the question to ask. Which is why my point again and again would be, I think the 2018 judgment was authored on the streets, was authored in struggle, was authored by communities in struggle, people in resistance, not by lawyers. They were the last people.
It's been over 2 years since the Supreme Court read down Section 377 of the IPC, granting a major victory to queer people across the country. Speaking at Oxford University in early 2020, lawyers Arundhati Kachu and Menaka Guruswamy talked about their marriage project.
I am extremely confident of seeing this in my lifetime.
That, they said, is the future of LGBT rights in the world's largest constitutional democracy. Menaka and Arundhati went on to represent two same-sex couples who petitioned the Delhi High Court to have their marriages recognized in India. At the time of recording, the case is pending and the court has asked the government to issue its response to the matter. Anjali Gopalan, founder of the NAS Foundation, the NGO which filed the PIL against 377 20 years ago, continues to work on HIV activism. She runs a care home for children living with HIV and AIDS and also has a shelter for animals in need of care. I ask her how she finds the energy to keep going.
You know, I will tell people that if they really believe strongly in something, they must pursue it, no matter what the impediments. Because if you strongly believe that change needs to happen and that those lives are important, then you stick with it and change will happen. Yeah, some people will give you a lot of grief, but that's okay. That's okay. How the hell does it matter?
Anand Grover, who represented the NAS Foundation in court, continues his work as an activist lawyer, but not without his share of challenges. In 2019, India's Central Bureau of Investigation filed a charge against Anand and Indra Jaisingh, his partner and fellow founding member of Lawyers Collective. The charges are related to the misappropriation of donor funding, which Anand has categorically denied.
It's quite difficult to face these things. Because not only is that these raids and actions by the government, they're not pleasant, but you have to deal with them. You've had losses in terms of cases, then you have another blow by the government. So we have to live with it. We have to suffer it and we don't lose heart. That's the way we have to live.
The Lawyers Collective is no longer able to access foreign funding, but Anand and his colleagues continue to work on human rights cases with the resources they're able to access. 377 is a legal podcast about a very specific law, its history, its impact, and the movement to get rid of it. But it's not by lawyers. We spoke with many, yes, but none of us on the team are legal experts. Why then did we undertake the mammoth task of trying to tell a comprehensive story about a law? Well, because the law doesn't exist just inside the courtroom. It plays such a pervasive role in our lives, and yet courtroom transcripts and judgments are some of the least accessible documents I've seen. In 2018, the judges in Navtej Johar talked about the need for sensitization campaigns. They asked for news about the verdict to be carried across the country. And yet, many activists believe that we still have a long way to go before citizens even understand their fundamental rights. The fight against 377 lends itself to analysis and scrutiny because it's so well documented. And credit for that goes to the countless note takers and scribes who archived the journey so well. It is really exceptional in terms of the amount of material that's available out there. When we started working on this podcast, I asked myself whether there was a lesson that could be learned here about fighting for your rights as a minority group, about going to the courts to ask for your rights to be guaranteed. Somewhat naively, I wondered if there was a blueprint of sorts. There isn't one. The Indian judiciary's recent track record isn't very promising for minority groups either. Whether it's the top court's defense of the Citizenship Amendment Act, or Article 370, or the Ayodhya demolition, or the National Registry of Citizens, fundamental rights are not always upheld or guaranteed. But the history of 377 still gives me hope. Because it reveals that legal cases don't have to be opaque. They don't have to happen behind closed doors. They can involve people, engage people. In fact, they often should, since they impact people so directly. Verdicts don't have to be top-down, imposed on us. The legal system doesn't have to be our enemy. Maybe the law, contrary to what most lawyers have told me, can be a place for activism. Thank you for listening to the 12th and final episode of 377. Justice Indu Malhotra's quote, which you heard in this episode, was read by Marissa De Silva. I'd like to extend my thanks to the various people who helped us along the way with their time, information, and assistance. This includes T. Jayashri from Kamra, Chintan Girish Modi, Gautam Bhatia, and Tarunab Khaitan for their legal guidance, Aniruddhan Vasudevan, Tripti Tandon, Mina Saran, all the people behind the archives of Orinam.net and the Alternate Law Forum, the countless scholars who have studied and chronicled this case so well, and many others whose names aren't mentioned here. And of course, a big thanks to everyone who took the time to speak with us for this show. 377 is a production of ATS Studio, a division of All Things Small. This episode was hosted by me, Sindhuri Nandakumar, and written by me and Ashim De Silva, who also produced the show. Script supervision is by Devaya Bopanna and Archana Nathan, with editorial input from Sidin Varukut and Supriya Nair. The music and sound design is by Madhav Ayachit, and the episode is mixed and mastered by Ankit Suryakant. Our executive producer is Gaurav Vaz. Our legal consultant is Amshula Prakash. We received administrative support from Anushka Mukherjee. All clips and voices used in this podcast are owned by their original creators. You can find more information about this episode and our show notes at allthingssmall.in/377.